it's nice to be here, and actually I checked in this morning at 9:15 or so, and I was afraid that all the organization wouldn't be done until 10 o'clock, but it's really a perfect organization, better than German-like, because actually they put me in the same office I was in 6 years ago. So when Antoine asked me to give a talk on our work on molecular electronics, then I of course agreed, but then after a second thought, well, after I had said yes, I figured out that actually much of the work we have been doing in this field is rather rudimentary at this stage. So I would like to put this into a somewhat broader perspective, and I would like to talk about electronic transport in single atoms and molecules, and the work on on transport through single atoms. That's this work by Elke Scheer mostly, where I was only marginally involved, but I think it's nice to have this as an introduction. And then I will talk about the current, what we've done in trying to identify that we are really measuring the current through single molecules. And then in the final 10 minutes or so, I would like to change pitch a little bit and talk about work that we've been starting on gold chains on silicon 111 surfaces, where one actually tries to get atomic chains, one atom width, on these surfaces, and tries to actually identify the local density of states. Okay, the whole thing, of course, starts when one looks at the issue of transport channels for conduction electrons. And as you know, when the width of a metal becomes of the order of the relevant wavelength of the electrons, which of course is the Fermi wavelength, then the conductance can actually be written in this form, implying that the nanowire is a waveguide for electrons, and this is the Landauer-Brüttiger formula, which actually arises in a very simple fashion. At least for an experimentalist, one can put it that simply. If you consider a one-dimensional system, that is a system where you have some sort of a scattering, random scattering potential, and you have one-dimensional leads that feed into this scattering potential, then you simply exploit the fact that the density of states for one-dimensional systems is given by 1 over essentially the Fermi velocity. When you actually calculate the current from the reservoir 1, say in one particular channel J, into this medium, this will of course, the current fed into S will of course be given simply by the charge, the velocity, the density of states, and the difference in the chemical potentials between right and left. And then, if you then have some scattering from this from the initial channel J into a final channel I, you have scattering transition amplitudes, and then the current through a channel I in the outlet will actually be given again by E squared over H, and then the scattering amplitude squared times again the difference in chemical potentials. And the point is then that simply because this Fermi velocity is cancelled by the expression of the density of states, then this drops out. That's the simple argument. So then finally the conductance is then given of the you just have to sum over all the J's, sorry for this misplacement, you have to sum over all the currents IJ then, actually, to get the conductance I over U, I over voltage, which then is simply given by E squared over H times the sum over all the channels I and J, Tij squared. And that's actually a simple rationale why we can use this simple, and if you diagonalize properly, this simple simple conductance formula. Now, in semiconductor heterostructures, the Fermi wavelength, because of the very low density of electrons, is much larger than the atomic dimension. And in this case, one actually observes very nice conductance quantization, and that has been shown already more than 10 years ago by Van Wees and others, where they have actually used a metallic gate deposited on top of a gallium arsenide, gallium aluminum arsenide heterostructure, and that could actually pinch off the channel between the left and the right electrode by actually applying a negative voltage to the gate. And as they did, the resistance, of course, rises, but it doesn't rise steadily, but in some sort of step-like fashion. And if they convert the resistance to the conductance, there's a very nice increase and plateaus in multiples of 2e squared over h. And of course, when the wavelength is larger than the atomic dimensions, then the potential looks rather smooth on the length scale of lambda f, and that's actually the origin of this nice conductance quantization. Now, in metals, the discrete atomic structure becomes important because in metals, the wavelength, the Fermi wavelength, is of the order of the lattice constant. So what one observes in metals is no conductance quantization, but on the lowest level, one observes that there's an approximate value of the conductance to e squared over h. And the question is now, when you look at this formula, does this 2e squared over h on the lowest plateau actually arise from a conductance quantum, that is one channel contributing 2e squared over h with, for this particular channel, tau r equals 1, or is it many channels or several channels that actually are contributing? How can one actually realize a constriction in a metal that that is only one atom or a few atoms thick? And the idea to this goes back to Rutenbeek and also the Paris group, Devoré and Estève. What they did is they actually, and we actually did that also, what one does is one evaporates on a metal a microstructure, on a polyimide a microstructure of this form with a constriction of, say, 100 nanometers. And then one has an under etch, so that one has a freestanding bridge over a length of, say, 1 micron or so. And this whole thing is then actually evaporated onto a bendable substrate. So when you use this piston here, you can actually bend the substrate. In a certain instant, this bridge will simply break. And then you can actually put it back together, and it will come together. And so in that sense, it's similar to a regular tunneling microscope, where you actually approach and the sample and can actually retract it again. And of course, it has a big disadvantage in that you don't have any lateral flexibility. You cannot sort of scan as you can do with the electron with the scanning tunneling microscope. But it has a very big advantage over the tunneling microscope in that the mechanical length of this thing is only 1 micron, 2 microns. So this is extremely stable. It is extremely stable compared to a tunneling microscope. Usually, you know, the tunneling microscope, the resolution is, say, of the order of 1 angstrom or so. And that is because the tunneling microscope actually is wiggling around like so, because of this huge, 2 centimeters huge in the sense to 1 micron, this huge mechanical arm that you have to employ for the tunneling microscope. So in that sense, this is a very stable configuration. And what one can then do is one observes these conductance steps and plateaus as a function of the electrode distance. And this is a rough estimate of the electrode distance simply by the mechanical transformation from this motion to the bending. Okay? And then here you already see that very often you don't see these conductance quanta, but you see differences. And also on the last plateau, there's often this conductance quantum 2e squared over h, but also some differences. And since this, you cannot tell from this plot, but this is actually exponential, an exponential decay as a function of distance. So the assumption one does is that this last plateau corresponds to the conductance through a single atom.
Can you refuse this? I mean, if you,
yep.
If you go back and forth.
Yeah, you can, yeah, that's what people have done many times.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see a histogram here. And that's actually, sorry for the German, that's the number of events over plotted over the conductance. And one sees these peculiar maxima, and one also sees that these maxima are not actually, that's not no quantization, but the maxima is actually set off by one and so the two and so forth. So the question that was addressed by Elkischer is, as I mentioned, can one actually tell how many quanta how many channels are actually supporting the last plateau in the conductance? And the idea is very simple. One has to look for a transport mechanism that is nonlinear in the tori's in the transmission probabilities, and such a transfer is Andreev scattering or Andreev reflection. And let me just explain that to you. If you have two superconductors, and we model actually the single atom as a normal sort of a non-superconducting barrier or something. If you have two superconductors, then if you want to transmit quasi-particles, you actually have to, in the semiconductor picture, it's obvious, but one can also calculate it. You have to actually apply a voltage that is at least two times larger than the energy gap, so that you can actually have a quasi-particle being transmitted, and actually then a whole reflected, and then you have some. I'm sorry, this is just a quasi-particle transmission, no Andreev reflection here, but you can actually have Andreev reflection. That is, you actually transmit two quasi-particles, or in a different language, in the Andreev language, you transmit one quasi-particle and a hole is scattered backwards and you form a Cooper pair on that side here. And you see from this picture, while here you need the energy difference of, or the voltage of two times the energy gap, in this case, you need a much smaller, energy difference, namely only voltage larger than 2 delta over 2, or delta, so that you can have actually two Andreev reflected, or one Andreev reflected particle, meaning that you actually go away here with a Cooper pair. And since you have actually to transmit coherently two particles, two quasi-particles, this probability is proportional to tau squared. And you can actually play this game further, and have, in a coherent fashion, transmitted three quasi-particles, that is two quasi-particles forming a Cooper pair, an additional quasi-particle going into an empty state. And for this process, you need the energy 2d, 2 delta over 3, and the probability is, of course, t cubed. And this is known as multiple Andreev reflection. You can actually continue with that. And this nonlinearity actually is, with this nonlinearity, it is possible to actually investigate the transmission probabilities individually. And an example is given here. This is, as I mentioned, due to Elkischer and co-authors. This is the current, just normalized to the normal conductance, normal state conductance and delta, versus the voltage. And if you have a very small normal state conductance, small compared to the conductance quantum 2e squared h, you see the typical IV characteristic of for two superconductors separated by a tunneling barrier. Namely, you see no current until you get two times the energy gap for the voltage, and then a very strong rise of the current, and then it goes into the ohmic regime. If you come into the region where the conductance is of the order of the conductance quantum, you still see these features here that actually this bending indicating that you have an additional increase around this voltage of 2 delta, meaning that this transfer of one single particle is still operating, but you also see distinct features at lower biases. And this is actually the Andreev reflection and multi-Andreev reflection. And what is shown here is actually the solid curves, actually calculations with a simple Andreev reflection picture with, of course, several adjustable parameters, and the parameters being essentially the number of channels and the transmission probability for each channel. And let me illustrate this by one particular curve. This is one of these curves shown in the previous graph, except now I've also divided by the voltage, so a linear curve in the previous graph would be a horizontal curve. So this would be the normal state, essentially the normal state behavior, the horizontal curve. And the blue curve is the best you can get by assuming only a single channel. And you can see it's really not working. And when you have two channels, there's actually already a better agreement, and three channels, you actually get rather nice agreement, and if you use more channels, the agreement doesn't get better, but you have only more parameters to play with. And what comes out of this is then that the sum of the transmission probabilities is roughly 0.9, and this is actually then in keeping with what I said previously, that the three channels are actually often cooperating on the last plateau to give roughly a conductance quantum, 0.1 instead of 1, as you would think. So Elkishé has done a lot with Rutenbeek and others, and the Paris group, Devoré-Estève, has done a lot of measurements on different materials. And so they determined the number of plateaus, say, for aluminum, niobium, and gold, and up there we have lead as well. And so for lead and aluminum, she often found three channels on the last plateau, doing the analysis I just indicated schematically. For niobium, there's five, and then there's extensive tunneling. There's an extensive tunneling regime with three channels, and then finally there's gold with one channel. So there seems to be a dependence of the number of channels on the last plateau on the element you're considering. Now you might wonder why she could measure gold, and it was actually done in the fashion that one drives the gold superconducting by using the proximity effect. So to summarize this, the determination of the number of channels on the last plateau, actually on each plateau, is possible, but on the first plateau after the tunneling regime, or last plateau before the contact becomes insulating, the number of channels seems to depend on the valence number of valence orbitals. And for monovalent metals like gold, as I showed you, there seems to be a maximum number of one. For polyvalent metals like aluminum and lead, there seems to be a maximum value of 4. And for transition metals like niobium, there seems to be a maximum value of 6. So it seems then that the number of possible orbitals is actually depending, or the number of possible channels depends on the number of valence orbitals. And the transmission of each channel then, of course, depends on the exact local rearrangement.
Excuse me.
Yep.
You say Fmax, does that mean that from sample to sample, the number of
variables
is always
the maximum? Yeah, the maximum. Actually, the most likely for lead and aluminum is 3, but the maximum observed is 4. And the most likely is actually at least made plausible by calculations in terms of a single LCAO model by Cuevas and collaborators. And they looked at aluminum and lead. Let me just discuss the case of aluminum, where they assumed an FCC-like structure with a central atom. And then the central atom, of course, has the S and P lobes as indicated. And so the idea is that in the calculation shows that for this neck atom here, there's a hybridization of the pz orbital, the z direction being this direction here, with the s orbital, and the px py orbitals remain almost atomic like in that they have the same position there where actually the 3p position is situated. And they also calculate the transmission, and they find that actually, so we have three channels actually contributing transmission, and actually then there is one channel that is transmitting rather strong, the SPZ channel, which goes in this SPZ channel, of course, would be going in that direction, so it's perhaps of no surprise that it's contributing strongly, and the PX and PY channels would transmit much less. However, this is only a first attempt, and there's actually a quite different approach why there might be the three channels actually cooperating in forming so often.
You said they observed this structure at the neck.
They did not observe. They assume. I'm sorry.
Because there's no knowledge. Of
yeah. Right. Neck. Oh no. Definitely not. Okay. They assume this neck-like structure. So what I was going to say was that actually the question is why on the last plateau do you actually see often this value of 2e squared over h, this quasi-quantization. It's not a true quantization, but a quasi-quantization. And there it seems to be rather accidental that the three orbitals, so to speak, combine to give this 2e squared over h on the last plateau. So a completely different approach was taken by Koha and Wölfler, and they actually assume, let me just... without a view graph, let me just tell you, they assume that you have some sort of condor-like resonance on this atom, and then actually you have the localized orbitals of the atom, of the single atom, hybridization with the conduction electron leads, and this would give rise to a condor effect. And then, of course, would be very interesting to find whether there's any distinct difference in the conductance quantization distribution for, say, even valent and odd valent atoms. And so we actually tried to, obvious candidate would be zinc, but let me just give you some view graphs of an unsuccessful experiment by trying to produce these point contacts for zinc. Instead of for aluminum, they look this way. So it's actually, you see there's the grains, you can actually nicely see the hexagonal structure of zinc on a nanoscale. But then this bridge is extremely brittle, so you can tear it apart once and then it comes together. And also the conductance quanta don't look so nice. So it's really... You see some plateau-like structures, but it's all very, very reproducible. Nevertheless, if you try to plot a histogram, you do see a maximum around 1, and perhaps also another one around 2, and you also see something that is quite interesting, namely a distinct difference between opening and closing the contacts. And so what one is actually now doing is actually doing sort of metallurgy, if you want, on an atomic level. So that's where we're stuck right now. We're trying to work with whiskers to actually decide on this question. Yep.
Mm-hmm. What's the temperature of the measurements?
All these measurements have been... that was all, of course, below the superconduction transition temperature. And when you want to measure the contacts in the normal state, you just apply a small magnetic field. Or you could go, well, depending, it really doesn't matter, you could go above for aluminum of 1 Kelvin or so. Mm. But essentially, the superconducting measurements have to be done at low temperatures.
What is the speed of the bending?
Typically, this I would say once every 5 seconds or so, you can open, close or so. I mean, I'm doing like this, but it's just tiny, tiny motions. Say 10 seconds or so. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that concludes actually the first part. And I now want to come to the discussion of the transport of single molecules. And surprise, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can I come back to this concept of a channel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you introduced it first by this imaginary picture that you have these independent wires from one reservoir to the constriction and then how should one theoretically really think of a channel? I think you use it then in terms of sort of atomic chains in a way, right?
Well, not really. No. Okay.
Yeah. So of course, a common use is you visualize a wire, and then you have different perpendicular modes, and each of those modes is a channel. Okay. So I've told you my understanding. Can you add to that?
Yeah. Actually, no, that's exactly my understanding, too, because what I mentioned in the beginning, this notion of the nanowire being a waveguide for electrons. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when you have this waveguide, you actually do not think of an atomic structure. You just say you have some sort of confinement for the electrons. And this works in the semiconductor case because the atomic corrugations, so to speak, are very small compared to the wavelength. But when you come to the metals, that's actually the point. You cannot distinguish, and it's between a atomic reconfiguration or a different mode transmission of the electrons. I would completely agree with that point.
So the mode picture is okay. Even for
these
atomic bridges?
No. The point I would make is that the change of modes cannot be dealt with without thinking about the atoms that are assuming different configurations. Because what actually is happening is you have plane waves, say, in the leads, and then you have the single atom, and then you have the valence orbitals and so forth. And if you change then, if you have two atoms or three atoms, or if the local atomic arrangement is different, then the transmission will be different. So it depends on the electronic, on the atomic arrangement as well. That's what I would think.
Didn't you say that it scales like the valency of these atoms?
Yeah.
So it scales with the number of valence orbitals which you have available?
Yeah.
That's what your measurements at least suggest.
Yeah, that's what I would think. But then also you see this wide distribution. You see the maxima, but you also have conductance values that are off the maxima. And this, to my understanding, just signals that you have different atomic configurations with different transmission channels. And the point is you cannot distinguish from between atomic positions and the conductance channels. I mean, it's just interconnected. I don't know if.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
It's much simpler. The concept is much simpler if you have a long wire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you have this kind of factorization of the wavefront.
Sure.
You don't have
yeah.
That.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to see what remains of that in this more difficult configuration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so actually now coming to this molecular business, it's maybe not surprising that we use exactly the same technique, namely these mechanically controlled break junctions to try to establish a contact to single molecules. And let me briefly explain how it is done. Again, we have this is just another break junction. This guy is gold because gold is usually used as a the material of choice for establishing the contacts to molecules. So we have these gold, the freestanding gold bridge, and again with 1 micron or so difference, and then we tear the bridge apart, and this time we tear it apart rather far, that is something like 10 nanometers. And then we apply a very dilute solution of the molecules we want to investigate. And the molecules are equipped with thiol end groups, that is sulfur and acetyl. And then the sulfur makes a covalent bond to the gold, and then we have actually then, it's almost like a hedgehog, these molecules sticking around on each electrode. And then we apply voltage, and then the molecules will be polarizing, and they will be sort of sticking out horizontally. And then we approach gradually, and then we evaporate the solvent, and then we approach gradually the two bridges or the two contacts until a contact or until we see some sort of reproducible contact. And let me mention that this technique was actually used previously in a pioneering experiment by Reed, where he actually used a benzene ring. Again, here the sulfur atoms, the thiol end groups, and the gold electrodes. And what he found is very strong features in the IV characteristic with a very low conductance for small bias, which he interpreted as the Coulomb gap. So obviously the question of Coulomb gap is an issue. That was in Science 1997. So what the question in this work, though, is whether there's really a single, molecule or a collection of molecules that are actually transporting the current, making the contact. And the idea we had was, and this work done together with Heiko Weber and Marcel Mayur, the idea was we had was to use a very simple approach in trying first to establish fundamental properties of the molecule which might be visible in the IV characteristic. And of course, a very fundamental property is just the geometrical symmetry of the molecule. So here, two molecules. They are connected. These are the sulfur end groups, and they are connected by a pi conjugated chain, essentially benzene rings here, and some pi conjugation in the middle. And this is referred to as the symmetric molecule because it is symmetric with respect to inversion along the molecular axis. And this is an asymmetric molecule because it carries a dipole moment along the molecular axis. And so we wanted to check whether we would be able to see any distinct differences in the transport when we use these two molecules. And here's first shown how actually a junction is formed. So in this case, we actually approach the two electrodes and we measure the current at a given voltage bias. And first we see practically nothing, and then we see a step-like increase, and then we see some wiggling, and then actually the current really shoots off. So it seems that if we were observing three different regimes, one with a low conductance, and that would seem to be insulating, and in fact, if you actually look at this on an expanded vertical scale, you see that the data, except some glitches here, are sort of roughly compatible with an exponential increase of the conductance. Of course, you have all the molecules around, so you don't have a vacuum, so it's perhaps understandable that you do see some strong deviations from this exponential increase. And then we come into this regime where we have a more or less stable configuration of the current, again with some sort of jumps or something, and then finally this, and this is where we believe we have contact between single molecule of the electrodes and a single molecule, and then finally we have this very strong increase of the current where we actually think that now the metals are touching. And roughly from the rough estimation of distances, this is actually consistent.
What amplitude of the current corresponds to the current quantum?
Pardon me?
Okay.
I'll show you pictures in the middle in the moment. But typically, what we observe is currents that are smaller than predicted by a conductance quantum, say roughly between 1/10 and 1/100th of a conductance quantum. it's arbitrary units. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not atomic units. Okay, so here we go with the measurements, and this again now the molecule sketched on the left, and this is the current in red over the voltage, and you can see here say 9 or so traces for the symmetric molecule, and then as you differentiate, you actually, this is in blue now, this is the conductance. So there are two observations. First of all, this seems to be rather reproducible, although there's some wiggling around. Even if you differentiate numerically, the curves seem to sort of reproduce well to a certain extent.
Excuse me, is that the same molecule?
The same, right. This is you actually have established the bridge, and then you sweep the current, the voltage several times. And typically a voltage sweep is something like a few seconds, 1 second to 10 seconds. Okay, so, and then the second observation is that for the symmetric molecule, you actually see in many cases, and I'll give you exception later, in many cases you actually see a symmetric IV characteristic. While for the asymmetric molecule shown below, there's always an asymmetric characteristic in the IV. You don't see it as well in the IV as in the conductance. So this is stable. Say you can sweep this 10 times or 9 times or sometimes 20 times, but then sometimes there's some rearrangement. I should mention that these measurements are all taken at room temperature. And then there's a change to a different behavior. And this is particularly true for the asymmetric molecule. So here, two examples. So you can actually follow this quite reproducibly, and then after a while it changes to a different pattern. And sometimes it looks as if, say, this structure here is just inverted to another structure, or this structure here becomes is maybe this one, and here comes something else out. And first we were very disappointed because we thought this is just not reproducible, but then we actually thought we saw the positive side in two respects. First of all, the distinct difference between the symmetric and asymmetric IV characteristics for the symmetric and asymmetric molecule suggests that we're really observing a single molecule, because otherwise then the asymmetric could stick either way and they would just average out. And secondly, that we see first of all reproducible features, and after a while we see a different type but still reproducible, also points to the fact that we are observing a single molecule but with different properties. Of course, the molecule itself will not change. That's a rather well-behaved object. What will change is actually the connection between the molecule and the gold electrode. And in that respect, quantum chemistry calculations by Reinhard Alrich and his group were very helpful. And they are sketched here. They actually looked at a gold cluster, 29 or 55 atoms, and attached a single, in this case, a single benzene ring over a sulfur to this molecule, and they then calculated the energy level spacing in the region of the homolumo, that is around the Fermi level, and they found distinct differences, say up to 0.4 or 0.6 eV of the level spacings around that homolumo level, indicating that possibly you just have different configurations of the atom, of the gold atoms binding to the molecule, or the sulfur atom of the molecule binding to the gold atoms. In particular, what they found is that you have several possibilities. Either the sulfur atom can bind to a single gold atom sticking out, or it can bind to two gold atoms on an edge, or it can bind to three gold atoms on an FCC close-packed surface. And for these, all the binding energies will be different, and also the Homo-Lumos level spacings will be different.
Didn't you say that you usually see the left one and only after some current for this
model? No. We are not at the stage in being able to assign specific IV characteristics to a specific configuration. I'm just saying that the typical change in behavior of the order of half a volt can perhaps be understood in these changes of the electronic configuration, which also amount to half an electron volt.
Is the switching driven by current, though, or is it?
We don't know. It could be thermal switching. And I'll show you some first low temperature measurements in a moment, but I mean, these are very preliminary. And actually, this is the first an attempt now to actually calculate the electrical current through a single molecule by Weigand, Kerntop, and Evers in Karlsruhe. And what they did is they calculated actually in a DFT model, the complete system of the molecule and 55 gold atoms on each side. And this then is the system S that was shown in this first view graph of the conductance. And this system then is coupled to leads, and the non-equilibrium Green's function method is actually applied to calculate then the IV characteristics. And what they find, this is a calculation for the symmetric molecule, is what they find is that they find distinct, first of all, they find this symmetric double peak structure, but they also find distinct differences whether the atom or the molecule is coupled to 1, 2, or to 3 gold atoms. And there's also some very strong broadening, which might be due to thermal fluctuations, and these thermal fluctuations might actually also drive the rearrangements of the contacts.
I don't understand why for the symmetric model your IV is symmetric. So, because the density of states shouldn't be symmetric around your chemical potential, your current potential, so that's something arbitrary, right?
I don't understand why for the asymmetric molecule the IV characters should be asymmetric. Because when you have just a given level spacing between two electrons, it should be symmetric as well. So the idea is that you have some sort of charge rearrangement that actually causes the asymmetry, much like in a diode, where you have actually the space charges driving making the current voltage character asymmetric. So that is actually the idea behind it.
But looking at this formula, just as the density of states isn't symmetric around mu.
Yeah, but that's the transmission. That's the transmission probability, TE. It's not the density of states. If you actually are changing the density of states via, say, inducing surface charges or whatever, then the characteristic may become asymmetric. Actually, there's also some more work that is done due to, put this up by Heurich Cuevas, because it was published in Physics of Letters this year, where they also calculated the IV characteristic. But opposed to the work I was just referring to, they actually looked only at the coupling of the molecule to a single gold atom. And so they actually neglected this problem of the different couplings that you have. So, but anyway, they also could reproduce some of the features. But let me repeat what I said when I think you asked about the the size of the conductance. Typically, for 1 volt, we have conductances of the order of 1 microamp. And so this is far less than you would expect from a conductance quantum. And while all the calculations up to now seem to indicate that you should actually be observing transport of the order of 1 conductance quantum, this is really unresolved questions. People have thought of, there was a reply in Physics of Letters last year that people think that you might have some, actually not a molecule contact, but 2 molecules, then and you have a weak transmission of electrons between 2 molecules. This is really an open question. Let me show you, though, that when we go to low temperatures, again, then we do see we do see actually very sharp features. And this, since this is the first preliminary experiment at 10 Kelvin, I'm really not in the position of commenting, except that in this case, really, it looks as if the position would be reversed and that one measures one molecule in one direction, and this would be the another molecule or the same molecule, but just attached in a different direction. And then finally, to actually underline this idea of the importance of the contacts, we can actually also induce now asymmetric IV characteristics in the symmetric molecule. And we believe this is now due to the different contacts which you make. So, and that of course reminds of a tunneling microscope where you can actually, when the contact is very weak on one side, then you would have more or less only one contact that is actually determining the IV characteristic. In that case, of course, you can have asymmetric IV characteristics. So this is a sequence of measurements taken by simply manipulating a little bit back and forth the distance between the electrodes. And you can actually go from a characteristic with a strong positive bias current to a almost symmetric current to a situation where at negative bias you have the strong current. But apart from that, you don't see these strong features you see for the asymmetric molecule. Of course, when so much depends on the contact between the sulfur and the gold, one would actually like to think of measurements that would try to get rid of this problem and actually measure properties of the molecule itself. And this is the first example where we have actually now produced, and this again, Marcel Mayor who did this, where we have produced a molecule where the pi chain, it looks rather similar to the molecules I showed you all along, except that the central benzene ring is now replaced by a platinum atom, which interrupts the pi chain. And of course, the molecule is symmetric, so it's of no surprise that we actually observe a symmetric IV characteristic. But then, in this case now, you see previously it was 1 microamp. Now it's 1 nanoamp. So this is actually strongly insulating, and we believe we are actually now measuring the intrinsic properties, the intrinsic low conductance of this molecule. And I should mention that there was some work on Kondo molecules, Kondo type molecules exhibiting the Kondo effect, but this cobalt was, platinum was replaced by cobalt. That appeared in Nature about 2 months ago I think one group was at Cornell University, McEwen, Ralph, and so forth. So I come to the last portion of my talk.
Can I ask a
question? Mm-hmm. Okay, sure. Mm-hmm.
Do they ever burn up? Somehow this whole picture of the transport is fully elastic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. You wonder, well, with this kind of voltages applied, presumably the power is dissipating power in the leads, but why can't the molecule undergo some kind of inelastic process where you excite some vibrational state or it actually enters an excited state?
Mm-hmm. I think, I think we're actually doing that, of course. I mean, probably these voltage or current spikes are due to, or not spikes, but maxima in the differential conductance are probably due to some electronic transitions or something. I think that is could be.
I would have thought the fact that you can reproduce them and sweep with the same molecule attached means that's probably not happening. That you're just measuring resonances and energy dependence of the overall.
Yeah, but still could be electronic transitions around the Fermi energy, and then of course the molecule relaxes again, and then you make the transition the next time, and so forth.
But could all the structural transitions? I mean, you have these tails on the molecule, and this tail really move completely to a different side if you put your count.
Mm-hmm. I think that is probably what happens. I mean, that after a while this thing becomes unstable, and then you get some sort of fluctuation, and it docks to a new position. I think that is what happens. But I mean, concerning your question, it's true. But I mean, often above 1 volt or so, these contacts become unstable, and you don't see anything anymore. So in that sense, of course, this whole thing, I hope I made this point clear, that this is not a very stable configuration. You know, the contact configuration changes, and also sometimes you blow off all the molecule altogether.
I still understood that when you see a symmetric conductance, you say this is a symmetric molecule, right? And you said that earlier somewhat, but I mean, if I have a density of states whatsoever, if I come from the right or the left, so why is that so clear to you that the symmetric density of state is a symmetric molecule?
No, maybe I put it wrong. What I wanted to say is that the fact we observe this, the IV characteristics reflect the fundamental symmetry properties of the molecule, suggest that we are observing the symmetric molecule and the asymmetric molecule for the symmetric and isymmetric IV characteristics respectively. I for me, it is not clear in that sense. We talked about space charges and different contact configurations, and actually I showed the example where the symmetric molecule produces asymmetric IV characteristics. So I think it's all a matter of the relative contact configurations, what you would observe.
I also want to ask about this. You mentioned this possibility in practice. The conduction is taking place through multiple molecules. To explain the low magnitude of the current. Do you have such control, some kind of control over the system that you can estimate the separation of the contacts before you immerse this in the solution, and then estimate when you bring the thing back, when you're first getting conduction? Do you have a sense of the distance compared to the physical size of the molecule? Mm-hmm. Is it comparable to one molecule?
I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. I mean, we open the contact, I mentioned that 10 nanometers, and then we approach it, and the molecules have a length of roughly 2 nanometers. And the approachment we have is actually compatible with this size of the contact distance of 2 nanometers. Okay, so any suggestions for clever experiments and are welcome to actually, as I mentioned, we are actually at the first stages of this.
Have you had any estimate of the Coulomb interactions in the molecule compared to the distance between different levels of the molecule?
I wouldn't be able to tell you offhand, but it depends. I mean, what you're asking is actually the sort of a ionization energy or with respect to the level spacing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to wind up with showing you a few, essentially only a few STM pictures on silicon, where we actually try to produce gold chains on the silicon. And again, this is in the first stages. And the whole thing actually started a few years ago when we investigated in detail the metal insulator transition in phosphor-stopped silicon. And the question, of course, is in these sort of critical phenomena at essentially quantum phase transition, you want to be sure that actually the silicon is actually distributed, I'm sorry, the phosphorus is distributed randomly in the silicon. And so we look for signatures of phosphorus in silicon. And what we found among other defects was actually a maximum, this is the 1-1-1, 2-by-1 reconstruction. And you see a sort of zigzag pattern, and that reflects the fact that in this on this particular surface, you have a reconstruction of the surface that you only observe that you have dangling bonds on each silicon atom along these rows, but they are predominantly occupied or predominantly empty at alternating sites. And this actually gives rise to the zigzag structure. And this is a protrusion and an indentation which we attribute to the phosphorus atom. And why we do this is coming up in the next view graph, where we actually have looked at this particular site at different voltages. And these are just different angles to actually illustrate the point I want to make. And the point I want to make is the following. The phosphorus, these are data taken at room temperature. The phosphorus is, of course, positively charged. And when it's positively charged, it changes the local density of states of the local surface density of states, pulls it down a little bit. And this means then that some density of states that is actually due to the unoccupied orbitals, I mentioned these zigzag orbitals, occupied, unoccupied, these unoccupied orbitals actually are going a little bit below the Fermi level. And that means if that is the case, then you would actually see in a certain range of voltages actually an orbital which would be usually unoccupied of this phosphorus site. And that means you would see in quotation marks an additional atom at this site. And I just want to show it, that's at this particular voltage here. So these are the pictures I showed you before. Now just tilt it a little bit so that you can actually see, you see atoms, 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 and that's all very nicely aligned. And if you go to this particular voltage, if you go here far away from this point, you see atoms, 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 and then minima, 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 and so forth. But then if you go down this way, this minimum, for instance, you have minimum, then something's coming up, and you have this extra atom here, and it's going down again. So this is really, looks like an additional atom, but it's simply due to this local charging effect around the phosphorus site. And with this picture, we actually were able to explain the features, at least from an experimentalist viewpoint, the features we see in this silicon phosphorus with the tunneling microscope and tunneling spectroscopy. And also what we found is that these features are compatible with the number of phosphorus atoms when you actually calculate the density of those. So with this,
how was that prepared? I mean, because you started with talking about doping. Yeah. Just an incidentally found phosphorus.
Yeah.
Phosphorus?
Right. Yeah. So the idea is we have doped silicon phosphorus where the doping was done from the melt. So you have essentially an alloy, and you cleave this alloy in ultra-high vacuum. And since you do that at room temperature, you get the 2-by-1 structure. And since you do it at room temperature, the phosphorus atoms stick wherever they are. Even the surface diffusion is so low that you see the phosphorus atoms that are just accidentally at that position where you have cleaved the crystal.
So if it's from the doping, I mean, it's not obvious if this what you see is a phosphorus atom at the surface or just in the second layer.
That's true. That is true. And we actually see features that are a little bit different that are sort of in the protruded layer, and that's roughly 50-50. I showed you an example of the uppermost level layer. Mm-hmm. The bulk concentration was up to 6 × 10⁻¹⁹, so up to 10 times the metal insulator transition. Because otherwise we wouldn't be able to, I mean, just the number density is so low, it's you look around for a long time until you see a phosphorus atom.
Is it known if there's, what the gradient or what the surface is? Because the bulk concentration surface or near surface concentration can be different.
Uh-huh. It might be known, but not, it's cleaved, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In equilibrium, you still, I mean, you have diffusion always, isn't it?
Yeah, but at room temperature, it's rather slow. I'm not aware of, you know, really strong phosphorus diffusion at room temperature. Otherwise our computers wouldn't work.
On the device loop, I know that there's quite some doping profiles at that interface.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, but, yeah.
In equilibrium, right?
Mm-hmm.
The question is how long you wait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Astro, of course, there's also a doping when you pull a crystal, there's actually a doping gradient, of course, because the solubility in the melt is different from the solid.
These properties are supposed to be in the first layer of the surface or on the surface?
It's in. It's in the surface. Mm-hmm.
You presumably could expose the surface afterwards to more phosphorus than you get at atoms, so that's a different phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we just weren't interested in. I mean, I'm not a surface physicist, so we would come from simple bulk measurements, but we just want to determine whether the phosphorus distribution is random in that material. That was the motivation. And I just wanted to show this here sort of how we got into this investigation of silicon surfaces. I mean, I'm giving credit to Scheffler, of course.
Was the phosphorus distribution random?
It was, yeah. It was really random, except there was a...
They didn't cluster.
No, there was perhaps a little anti-clustering.
Right.
That's perhaps a question to you. Might be feasible, in my view, because when you actually take the distance, the minimum distance observed... I'm sorry, I didn't have the picture. So this is what you would expect roughly from a Poisson distribution, and look something, our data look perhaps something like this. And there was some phosphorus missing below 17 angstroms. And if you take that literally, this translates roughly to the solubility limit of phosphorus in silicon, which is something like 2 to the 20 or something like that. So we thought maybe it's not unreasonable to have this, this, but definitely there's no clustering. Okay, but then we took actually now the 7x7 structure, I'm sorry, the silicon 111. And evaporated some gold. Oh, here, I'm sorry. First, this is the 111 silicon structure, but cut 10% off. And this is essentially to show you that one also in this picture is actually seeing the 7x7. The 7x7 structure here. Okay? But you can only see it if you have accidentally a terrace which is wider than the typical 7x7. So here it's harder to see. You see here these points that are reminiscent of the 7x7 structure. And then we evaporate gold, and then the structure looks completely different. And then we really get these nice chain-like behavior. We get some additional protrusions here, which have been observed very often, and not only by us, but by other people as well. And one possibility is that this is due to extra silicon atoms sitting at the surface, and which are actually protruding after the reconstruction, after the evaporation by gold. And so this, an enlarged view, and these are then the terraces, and we see nice distinct features here, and then we see some sort of diffuse chains. And the question is, where is the gold? The question is, where is the gold? And this is a question no one has answered up to now, and we are actually struggling to find an answer. And so what we have done is we have actually positioned the STM on one of these sort of nice chain-like structures here, and on these diffuse rows here. And some examples are shown in the next slide. So the upper panel shows structures on these IV characteristics, on these chain-like structures, and you see this maxima around 1 volt, and then there's a gradual rise. And then the lower panel shows data where we have actually positioned the STM more on the diffuse rows next to these nice chains. And there we see some feature here at 0.5 EV, but also characteristic features around 2 to 3 volts. And we've checked in the literature, and there is surprisingly little known on this gold reconstructed silicon surface. This is a rather recent calculation by Sanchez Portal. And what they did is actually they calculated the density of states and the diffusion, the dispersion relation for electrons for gold atoms, which have the right distance to the silicon atoms, right as determined from the structure analysis. But then they didn't consider any further silicon atoms, but simply terminated the bonds by hydrogen. And that is their calculation there, their dispersion relation. And when you look at their data and actually look at these lower data here with these characteristic peaks at higher voltages and then small peaks here at lower voltages, there is some resemblance between our density of states measured and their calculations, in that their band maxima or minima around points where we actually see maxima in the DIDV. And that is actually the current status. And we would encourage theorists actually to look at the surface in more detail and try to come up with a realistic calculation of the gold chains, because it's an interesting system. Maybe some of you have followed this up. There was a controversy that from photo emission that this gold chains would actually behave like Luttinger liquid. This was worked by Yves Baer and others, but then there came Himsel and said it's perhaps just the band structure of the gold on the surface. So it's actually a very interesting system. And these are the first attempts actually to actually just derive a local electronic density of states. So I would like, as a final view graph, I would like to put up the view, the people that have actually done the work. So that's Elke Scheer with the French group, essentially, and then Heiko Weber together with Marcel Mayor, who did the chemistry on the point contact. And then we have a nice collaboration with the theory group at our university and some German, which you don't need to read the acknowledgement for the funding. And with that, I would like to close and thank you for your attention. Sure.